This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Maybe not the Redskins. I saw somewhere that it's not RG3, it's RG0-3.
Now, here's your host.
Hi, this is your host, Darizy Handelar of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net, filling in for Mike Petrelli. And hopefully I'll do a good job because I'm a little under the weather. But now, join me in welcoming my very spirited co-host, the Denver Broncos of Education Policy, Michael Brickman.
Glad to be here. And, you know, the Denver Broncos are looking good. Peyton Manning is looking scary good right now. Not sure he can be stopped, but, you know, we're going to just go that way in education reform, too. We can't be stopped.
There you go. I feel like everyone expected me to bust out with some pop culture reference. The Emmys were last weekend.
Didn't watch them.
I'm sure there's some sort of Miley Cyrus news that Mike would be bringing up now at this point. But I spent most of last weekend watching football, and I'm sure you did, too, which is why I immediately thought about the undefeated Denver Broncos. Patriots looking good. The Redskins not so much.
My Packers will get there. Don't worry. They're 1-2, but they'll make it.
And I'm a Niners fan by proxy, just because people I know are. And I'm from Los Angeles. You have to pick some team, but maybe not the Redskins. I saw somewhere that it's not RG3. It's RG0-3. Which brings us to our first question. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Journalist and author Amanda Ripley has been gaining a great deal of attention for her newest book, The Smartest Kids in the World, and for her condemnation of the fact that the U.S. consistently spends more dollars per high school athlete than it does per high school math student. Is she right?
Well, she's right about the numbers, or at least we have to trust that she's right about the numbers. But this is a really good question. She brought it up in her book. It's also the cover story of this month's Atlantic magazine, that not only are we spending a lot of money on high cost sports like football, but that it actually detracts from the academic atmosphere of schools. And yet school administrators aren't even considering cutting things like sports. And you try and cut something like sports and the community explodes and they're not having it. What do you think?
Well, I think, again, yeah, we have to take her numbers at her word. And certainly if schools are spending dramatically more on a single sport than a single core academic subject, that's probably an issue. But I don't know. I think sports are an integral part of growing and being a well-rounded person. We've seen the recent Jay Greenfield trip study. Mike said, called extracurriculars the secret sauce of our education system. I think it was this week on our website. And you know, I think ultimately sports and other things are good for character development. And let's face it, for some kids, being able to play Friday night on the football field is enough to make sure that their grades are up. For some kids, that's not the case, but for others, it is.
What about the kids who have to, everyone in the school has to show up at 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning because you have to start school early because you need time for football practice after school? I mean, there's a lot of externalities that we're not considering here. And while I agree with you, I mean, I was a athlete in high school, but it was certainly possible for me to pursue those opportunities outside of school. I didn't need to play on my high school soccer team. I could have played on my club team, my travel team, or something like that. So is this something that is so ingrained in American education that we need, that it's a right of every student to have this, or should we consider it more of a privilege?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that it's fair to necessarily blame start times and other things like that solely on football. I'm sure there were activities that you did in high school that required you to be there after school, and you didn't want to be there till 7 or 8 o'clock at night, which is reasonable. Arne Duncan's brought up the sleep issue and maybe moving it back. I don't think that that's necessarily unreasonable, but it's not just football.
I think then that the other question that this brings up is a policy one, right? We trust school boards and district administrators to make reasonable budgets. There's no mandate telling them where to cut, that they need, if they're tightening their belts, that they should make larger classes or cut art and music or whatever. But if districts and administrators are not even thinking about cutting sports programs and instead they're cutting academic programs, do they need more of a mandate to do so?
No, I don't think you want to be mandating that type of thing on local school districts. I think administrators need to be responsible enough and held accountable if they are every year buying the fancy new football uniforms rather than the fancy new science lab equipment. But you can't have a mandate for something like that.
Question number two.
On Monday, Florida Governor Rick Scott issued an executive order withdrawing the Sunshine State from PARC. Bobby Jindal and Scott Walker, governors of Louisiana and Wisconsin, respectively, have also expressed reservations about the Common Core of late. What's making GOP governors go wobbly?
Well, I think it's a whole host of issues. Obviously, political issues are part of it. But ultimately, I think this is a case where you have a very vocal set of opponents and a really core group of supporters who are not near as vocal. And, you know, I think a lot of people who aren't in government or who haven't worked in government don't realize sometimes, but the phone calls and the letter writing campaigns, even if it's, you know, a couple dozen people contacting their legislators or their other elected officials, that makes a difference.
So what are your recommendations then for Common Core supporters to perhaps engage in mobilization or be a little bit more vocal so that they are more of a presence for these governors?
Well, yeah, I think they have to match the intensity of the opponents if they want to make sure that these types of things are protected in states where there are vocal minorities of people who are opposed to the Common Core. But I think they also have to be willing to engage legitimate opposition. I mean, certainly we've all heard the crazy rumors and speculation and just stuff being said about the Common Core out there. And there's kind of that fringe element to it, but at the same time, there are people who legitimately oppose the Common Core who have legitimate concerns. We might disagree, but I think there needs to be a debate, and we have to be, as proponents of Common Core, willing and excited to have that debate.
And topic number three.
A Wall Street Journal editorial blasted Philadelphia's teacher union for dragging its feet on Governor Corbett's bailout of the failing district, which is conditional on elimination of teacher seniority rights and basing future pay increases on achievement-based teacher evaluations. What's the backstory?
All right, this is a case of complicated politics and spin. On the one hand, this editorial and many others have, as you said, blasted the teacher union for not accepting the deal. The union has made the point that this is sort of a devil's bargain, that if they say yes, that they are giving up not only immediate job security, but basically everything that teachers' unions nationwide have been fighting for the last 40 or 50 years. And I think this is a case of, if you attack a union or any organization on their founding principles, they're going to feel backed into a corner. And it doesn't matter how rational you think the deal is, they're not going to accept it because it is threatening their very identity and existence. So, you know, regardless of, you know, how exaggerated or not these claims are, I think that expecting an organization like a labor union to think completely rationally and not emotionally about a deal like this is rather short-sighted.
Well, I don't know. I think you also have to look at how we got there and what role the unions played in that, because other core principles of union bargaining and union advocacy for years and years has been spending and staff pay and staff benefits. Philadelphia spends about $16,000 per kid. Each teacher makes about $125,000 a year in both salary and benefits. And I'm sure there are teachers from Philadelphia who say, well, I don't make anywhere near that. But the benefits are very expensive, very generous. They don't contribute towards them. And they're probably not administered very efficiently, because guess who administers a lot of the benefits? The union. So I don't know. I think that the union is has not had a lot of stake in the past in Philadelphia and elsewhere in being fiscally responsible. And if they are willing to trade some of their core principles, as you say, Dara, for the money, I think they need to be part of the solution as well.
I think you make a very good argument and a convincing argument, but I want to counter you with two things. First of all, there has I grant you, been an enormous amount of fiscal irresponsibility, but part of that has actually been the problem of the state and not the district. So the district is having to deal with very poor decision making and very short-sighted decision making by the state when it comes to retirement benefits, and now the district has to pay for it. So Corbett coming in and saying, I'm here to save you with this bailout, is perhaps a little bit of smoke and mirrors when the state is the cause of some, if not necessarily all, of the problems in the first place. So that's point number one. Point number two is that, yeah, some teachers might be making $125,000 a year, but the teacher might counter that with, well, why shouldn't we be making that amount of money? So I think that the issue here is not necessarily the bottom line, but that the expenditures have to be tied to quality, that there is no reason why a high quality, highly effective teacher shouldn't be making $125,000 a year in total compensation once they dedicate their career to providing a high quality education. It's just that these expenditures have to go hand in hand with quality control.
I totally agree on, I guess, your second point first, that teachers should, yeah, if they're quality, and I think that's the big if they're demonstrating that they're doing a great job in Philadelphia, and I'm sure there are lots and lots of really fantastic teachers in the Philadelphia public schools and in the charter schools. But when you have so many kids, tens of thousands of kids who can't read, who aren't graduating from high school, and yet nearly 100% of the students are rated effective, I'm sorry, 100% of the teachers are rated effective, that needs to be kind of considered in the whole picture. And regarding some of the stuff at the state level, agreed, and there are certainly politicians of all persuasions who have been very irresponsible and have definitely looked to the short term instead of the long term. But you know, there is certainly a role being played, again, by the unions, who have spent lots and lots of money to elect these people. And then when it comes to sitting down at the negotiating table with the people they helped elect, they get, surprisingly, a lot of the things that they want.
No, you're right. That is a very good point. So I think on this entire thing, I would urge the Philadelphia Union to take a more active voice when it comes to quality control. That obviously their institutional purpose is to protect their teachers, to protect their teachers' job security, to protect them from capricious firing. So be a part of the discussion when it comes to quality control, and then you might not have people balking when they hear how much a teacher might make per year at the end of their career.
I think we can agree on that.
Let's stop it there and move on to everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show, and selfishly welcome back because I'm not doing the Research Minute anymore.
Thanks, Dara. I haven't listened to your Research Minutes. I can't wait, but I just said, hey, it's hard to do a minute, isn't it?
It is. And it's, you don't crazy. Need to listen to them. Let me assure you that they were excellent.
No, they
were. The highest possible quality.
I have no doubt. Oh, buddy.
Thank you so much. So, welcome back. Should we call you Dr. Northern?
Northern, yes. That is my new name. It's really hard. I'm practicing signing it, which is always fun. But anyway, yeah, it's hard. I'm still calling myself Winkler. I think it'll be a while before, you know, when you've been 29 years at Winkler, it's tough.
29 years.
Yes. Wink.
Well, what do you have for us today?
We've got a new study. Does accountability matter in terms of long-term outcomes is a question a lot of us answer, especially when we're accountability hawks. And that's basically the new, it's a new study out by NBER, by David Deming. And they look at this question of, does accountability matter? And they look at the accountability pressures that Texas public schools were under in the 1990s. I think most of us know the accountability policy in Texas were the sort of the foundation of NCLB. So your school basically, got a rating based on how your lowest performing kids did. So, and there was also, which is an interesting nuance that I'd forgotten, districts received accountability ratings based on their lowest rated schools. So the low performing schools really have an incentive and pressure district wide to improve. Basically, the pass rates on the 10th grade math exam were almost always the obstacle to a school receiving a higher rating. So the analysts say the impacts on these outcomes can be considered a direct test
of the influence of accountability, which is important. So it's causal in that way. So they track five cohorts of first-time ninth grade students from 1995 to spring 99. They compare similar students within the same schools, but across cohorts. All right, key findings. Schools at risk of receiving a low-performing rating responded by increasing the math scores of all students, with particularly large gains for students who had previously failed an eighth grade exam. They're also more likely to graduate from high school. They're more likely to accumulate more math credits, and they're more likely to attend college. I already say that. Anything. Every outcome was positive. They earn more at age 25. It's around 1% more, which sounds really small, but it was statistically significant, and it also aligns with what the Chetty study found in terms of outcomes, earnings outcomes at that age. Low-scoring students in particular are about 14% more likely to attend college, 12% more likely to get a degree compared to similar students. But then this is kind of the rub. For schools that weren't in danger of this low score, there was no overall impact for them. And in some cases, their kids saw declines in their earnings, especially for the low achievers. So, for instance, students who had failed an eighth grade math exam and attended a school that wasn't in danger of being low performing earned about $700 less at the age of 25. And this was kind of a weird finding. They also found that those schools ended up putting more special education kids or assigning more kids as SPED to take them out of the accountability pool. So I think in my mind, the bottom line is that schools respond to incentives. This is kind of the dull finding. And even crude accountability policies, of which these were pretty crude accountability policies, can translate into meaningful long-term outcomes for kids, either good or not so good.
So what does this do to, what does this say to one of the common critiques of accountability in that you end up focusing on the bubble kids, the low achievers? I mean, it sounds like in the bottom schools in the accountability system that the low performers really did see these gains, but what about the students who are already proficient or already high achieving?
Yeah, so I mean, there were overall gains, so let's not mask that. It's just that the impacts for the low performing kids was even greater, but we didn't see that again in the schools that weren't in danger. So the schools that were in danger, it was like everybody benefited, but the schools that weren't, we didn't see that. The incentives didn't work the same way. So, but yeah, it was a very, I mean, the policy was created for the low performing kids. I mean, the bubble kids were, you know, it was just a no-brainer to concentrate on those kids because that was how the whole policy was constructed. I mean, I think we've got a next generation accountability system now and models, and we're trying to do better in sort of how we think about and frame these things. But, you know, this was accountability 1.0 in many ways. So I think we learned a lot from it. And obviously NCLB, you know, the main tenets of NCLB were clearly based on it. And so, you know, now we're looking at things like value added, and we're trying to figure out, okay, what subgroups should we really be caring about? So it really gave rise to all the questions I think that we're wrestling with today.
So if this is accountability 1.0, is there anything that people are talking about as far as accountability 2.0 goes that would ensure that it's not just the bubble kids and the low performers that receive our attention?
I mean, I think that's what we're talking about now in the types of tests we're devising, you know, and the next generation of assessments. We're talking about, you know, we multiple choice are fine, but we also want some performance-based tasks. We also want kids working in groups. We also want to know that they can speak and write and they have listening skills. So I think all these things we are talking about and trying to assess now. And this, you know, this was the tax test. A lot of people say this was not a great test, and compared to some of the tests that we're developing today, that's probably true. So I'm less concerned about the downfalls of an accountability system, frankly, after reading this, because this was a very crude system based on a not so great test, and we still saw positive impacts for kids. So those of us who, you know, care about accountability and want to shape it and get it right, this is an important study for us to read and reflect upon.
So it sounds like that even in the very beginning we got the fundamentals right, and now it's the details that we're working out, but the path is going in the right direction.
Yeah, that's what I'm taking away.
And included in some of those details, as you mentioned, are the low performers in the schools that typically pat themselves on the back. Are there things that states or districts can do to make sure those kids don't get lost in the shuffle?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is what we've always wrestled with around Fordham. You know, let's not forget the high achievers. We've got a whole line of work around high achieving students. And you know, Checker's written a book on these schools that sort of elite schools. And I think it continues to be a problem. And I think that's why we've got to really care more about online learning and customization of learning and differentiated instruction, all the things that we talk about here, because those kids need just as much attention as the other kids do.
All things that we will continue to think and write about. Thank you so much. Until next week.
I'm Michael Brickman.
And I'm Darzy Handelar for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.